Hello and welcome to the Two Time Labs podcast. I'm Francis Wade, and if this is your first time listening, welcome to my podcast where I interview thought leaders in the area of time-based productivity. I'm on the hunt for the latest, newest, research-based breakthrough ideas in the area of time management and personal productivity. And if you're curious in any way about the latest research on how it all fits together, pick up a copy of my book, Perfect Time-Based Productivity, from Amazon.com. In today's show, I'll be interviewing Tanya Dotson. Tanya splits her time between Europe and the United States, and she's an expert coach, and during the conversation, I hope you'll see why. She delves into the reasons why we make the time decisions we make as adults. So she helps her clients go all the way back to when the decision was first made, which could be sometime in their childhood or in their teens, and how that shaped the rest of their life. And she helps them to actually make brand new choices now that they're adults. So during the conversation, you'll actually hear her coaching me a couple times where I had a really interesting and first-time breakthrough in an area that's important to me. So keep listening. Interview with Tanya Dotson is coming right up. Hi, and welcome back to the Two Time Labs podcast. And as I mentioned in the introduction to the show, today I have a very special guest. Tanya Dotson is joining us from New York, and she is a specialist in coaching individuals in applying new and improved time management behaviors. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you also. And maybe we should start off by just filling in some gaps, because I know you started off your professional life at Princeton.
Yes, I did.
And ended up in Denmark and then New York. And maybe you can fill in all the middle and the beginning and the afterwards and tell us all about you so we can have an idea of how you decided to pursue this path.
Okay, well, great. Thank you so much. This is the epitome of the road less traveled by. I'm one of those people that really likes to stick my nose out and go places where, you know, you wouldn't typically go. So it started, like I said, it started at Princeton. I graduated with a degree in psychology and community service. And then I actually spent a year and a half in medical school. And that had been my pathway, you know, the whole way through high school and, was pre-med in college and all of that. And I got there and went, no. This is not for me.
Gotcha.
Now, you know, the idea of it was really, really interesting, and the reality of it was something completely different, you know, so it wasn't what I would have imagined it to be at all. So that left me kind of like, okay, well, what am I going to do now? So I had gone to medical school in Georgia at Morehouse. So I went back to New York, and I started working in the mental health industry, and as I was working there, there was an application for a public service MPA, back in the day, they used to call it a Master's of Public Administration from New York University, and the fellowship was in community service. So, yeah, I said, let me apply for this, and this sounds really, really interesting. So I did the program. It was a 3-year program for an MPA, which is now called the Master's of Public Service. And, what was really great about it was this is the first time in my life anybody ever paid me to study. So, you know.
It doesn't get better than
no,
that.
No, it really doesn't. Not when you see the student loans that you're paying off, you know. So, as a fellow in community service, it was, in community development, excuse me, you know, it was an opportunity for me to combine the psychology with community service work. So, actually, for 10 years, I was in the forefront of the AIDS crisis that was going on. So, I was a researcher. And I was a counselor, so that was pretty much as close as I got to medicine. I was working at Downstate Medical School, Kings County Hospital. So I had the white coat on, and it had medical counselor on it. And I thought, cool, this is what I'm actually supposed to be doing, you know.
Not going on the inside of the person.
Exactly. It was really
take out spleens and stuff.
Right.
To work with their minds.
Exactly. You know, capturing the minds and hearts of women that were at risk for HIV back then in 1980. Mm-hmm. What was this? This is 1987. So this was the first heterosexual women's research program or project on for HIV and AIDS. So, you know, it was absolutely amazing to be at the forefront of this. And that took me to the AIDS conference. I wrote the abstract for our department, and it got accepted for the third International AIDS conference in Sweden, in Stockholm, Sweden. So there you go. Mm. That's how I got to Europe.
Okay.
So I did a presentation. We were doing a poster presentation for the AIDS conference about our study. We had unfortunately discovered that 25% of the women that we had tested for HIV and AIDS and had done the screening for with the, you know, the questionnaire and everything, 25% of them tested positive. So that was a really major hit. Not in a good way. You know, it was a major hit for heterosexual women. It was a major hit for the research community, and it was just, you know, it was shocking and horrifying and all of that. But it was, you know, information that was important to have. So,
right.
When I got to the conference, it's interesting how life turns you around and points you in a certain direction. You know, you think you're going one way, and life goes, no, you're going this way. So that's kind of what happened. The doctor that I was working with at Downstate Medical School was Danish. And so when we got to the conference in Stockholm, we weren't staying at the hotel like everybody else. We were staying in an apartment in Stockholm with about 25 Danish people, you know, and that's how I got into the Danish community. I met a whole bunch of people, and they were lovely, and I traveled through Europe. There was Stockholm, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, and Paris. And I always said that if I had known more people in Amsterdam, I probably would have wound up there. But I knew these people in Denmark, so when I came back, you know, I was a couple of years, you know, 1.5 years back here, and then off to Denmark I went.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, so you thought it would be a 2-day trip that turned into like a multi-year?
Yeah.
Was it that originally started off as just the conference?
Yeah, it really was. That was it. It was the conference and just, you know, checking out Europe while I was already over there, and it was being paid for, and, you know, so I had, I think I had 7 days in each city. You know, so there was 7 days in Stockholm for the conference, and then there were, you know, and a couple of days off, and then 5 to 7 days in Copenhagen, and then 5 days in Amsterdam, and then the same thing, you know, 4 or 5 days in Paris. And then back to the States, and then, you know, we carried on with the project, and it got amazing funding, and, you know, it got $5 million in funding for the next couple of years. But by that point, I was, you know, starting to close down shop. You know, my focus was now on Europe.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you continue that work in Europe?
I did. I did for a few years. In Copenhagen at that time, they were really advanced medically, but they were really in the dark ages as far as information was concerned. So I carried on in a program called the Hospitals Stay-at-Home Program, all the while with an eye on working with the doctor that I had originally met at the conference, who was the best friend of the Danish doctor that I worked with in New York. So that was an amazing trip, because he was doing his PhD at that time, and the PhD was going to be a halfway house between the hospital and homestay for people that had been hospitalized, but they were too well to be in hospital, but too ill to be home.
Right.
So I wound up working as a psychosocial counselor at that program when it finally got funded. And I did that for 3 years. And, you know, over time you lose a lot of people. And after that, that was when I said, you know, after 3 years, I was like, okay, that's enough. I'm done with this part of my career. And I, you know, kind of kicked around and did some, you know, after school program work. I developed my first company in Copenhagen, which was family work, is something, you know, that I used my background for in community service and community development to do with another partner, who had a background in social work. So we put together a program called Bridge Builders, and we were very, very successful working with families in crisis and especially their children. And we were able to keep all but 4 children out of care. So we were able to keep these children at home by working with them and their families. And, you know, that's like, we're talking about 60 families, you know, with an average of 3 kids each. So it was, yeah, that was a, so that's when I got a real taste for, okay, you know, now I'm really going off grid, you know, off the grid, and I can actually create programs that work. Yeah. So that was the first one we did that. And then I started getting really, really interested in, you know, coaching, had been doing the family coaching for so long. So then it was, you know, to start to do individual coaching with people. And, you know, there were two areas that I was really, really interested in. And one of them was time management, because I've been there. You know, there's no better person to try your techniques out than on yourself. You know,
true.
You know, so I allowed myself to be the guinea pig, and I tried out a whole bunch of different techniques and tools, because, you know, there's always the you know, the self-help books and the, you know, five tips, and you know, you can change your life in 3 days with these 21 tips, but that's the author's tips. You know, that's what worked for the author. That's not necessarily what's going to work for you. So I got really determined to take some of this technology and to transform it in a way that it could work for anybody, you know, and I used myself, like, okay, if it can work for me, you know, it can work for anybody. So that's when I started developing this, you know, 180-degree time management technique.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long ago was that? How many years have you been delivering programs?
Oh, let's see.
Of that nature,
I started this company, which is called Synergy People, in 2010. So, you know, approximately 4 or 5 years I've been doing this.
Right. And I'll let our audience know, it's synergypeople.dk/EN. I guess the EN would be for the English version.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And there's also an American flag on the site, so, you know, you can just click on that. If you just went to synergypeople.dk, you can click on the flag and you'll get over to the English page.
Oh, I'm looking at the Danish version. Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, right? Very interesting.
I don't understand a whole lot of it, but it sure looks very interesting.
That was my experience as well for the first, you know, couple of years working with that Danish doctor. It was like, what are you saying? You know? It's amazing to come from that to actually being able to understand, read, and write the language.
Right. That's awesome. How many languages do you speak? Is it just the English and the Danish, or have you picked up others well in Europe?
No others well. You know, I can understand a bit of German and some Swedish, but and a little bit of Dutch, you know, but just to basically order a cup of coffee or get on a bus. That's as far as it goes.
That's more than so many of us. Well, I love that you've translated a desire to make a difference with families and with children and with at-risk communities to sort of, I guess, the mainstream individual who has a struggle in managing him or herself so that they use time wisely. It's almost like going from, you know, real helping people who are in distress and who are at risk to helping those of us who aren't necessarily at risk, but who would love to have a benefit of peace of mind and productivity and, but have it from someone who has that kind of commitment. I love that you brought your commitment to sort of the mainstream.
Thank you. And, you know, I do see us at risk. You know, I see us, those of us that are struggling with time management, you know, getting stressed out and, you know, taking time from our families and our children and our, you know, our partners, you know, and our romantic life to get the job done. You know what I mean? And that is at risk for me, because you're not actually living fully. You may have started this company or this business because it was your passion. And now your passion is sucking the life out of you. And that wasn't the intention.
Happens all the time.
Yeah. So
yeah, we somehow get stuck, right?
Yes, we do. And then, you know, you're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, which means, you know, you're taking from your family, or you're taking from your free time. You don't even schedule free time anymore. You know, it just kind of happens when you're, you know, exhausted lying on the couch, you know, and you finally, you know, you've finally turned your phone off, or maybe it's even lying there beside you. And every time you get a tweet, you know, you're leaping across the coffee table to pick it up. So are you actually off or are you not off? You know, and then you get to times where you want to take vacation and you've scheduled a vacation, and then there's something that you didn't finish with your business, whether it's your invoicing or, you know, another product that you need to put out or your website that needs to get launched, or you've got to do some content for your website. And here you are on the plane to, you know, the Bahamas with your laptop, you know?
That is exactly, and well, you plan to use it when you're there too.
You're hoping against hope that you don't have to, that you can get it all done on the flight. You know, and then, you know, that's the hope, right? You fool yourself.
That futile feeling.
Absolutely. I'll get it done on the plane. And I don't get, you know, and then you get there and you haven't managed to get it done on the plane. And then there you are, this beautiful beach in front of you, and you're sitting at the cabana with your laptop. You know?
Living a life that you didn't want.
Exactly. But I'm on vacation because I'm in this, you know, gorgeous spot, or I'm in Hawaii, or I'm in, you know, Italy with my laptop. And if anybody can relate to that, that's where I said, there's got to be a better way. There absolutely has to be a better way than dragging this laptop with you, you know, everywhere you go. And, or having, you know, the typical one. You see it in the movies all the time, right? You're on a date with your beloved, and your phone, you get that indication sound, you know, whichever sound that you've got, boop, boop, boop. Right?
Or vibrate, or
right. And then you're
flashing
like,
light.
Right.
Or,
and you're looking into the eyes of your beloved or somebody that you really want to date and get into, and one moment, please. Let me just answer this email, or let me just, you know, tweet this, you know, tweet, or, oh, look, there's something. Yeah, and you've gone completely off topic, and you're, again, taking away time from where you should be relaxing, you know, time where you should be, you know, romancing your partner, time when you should be, you know, how about just enjoying the meal that's in front of you, you know?
Mm.
And we see it all the time.
Yeah, on your website, you write about time becoming the enemy. Is how does that happen? Is this the sense in which you're speaking, in which we feel as if we're struggling against something that we can't win?
Yes.
With or against?
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's why I did write. I wrote 180 degree time management. Time is not the enemy. It's not time. Time's like gravity. You know, time is. And, you know, you can do whatever you want, but you're never going to change that. You're never going to change the fact that everybody gets 24 hours in a day. You get it. I get it. You know, presidents of countries get it. People that are running, you know, governments get it. We've all got 24 hours. So it's not so much, it's not time that you need to use less of, or, you know, all these tips and things of the trade. It's your relationship to time. It's your mindset about time. And it's really interesting, once I start doing the work with people about what your mindset is about time. Like, you know, some of us are in denial, and we think that, you know, someday we'll get a little bit more time, you know, like the 24 hours is somehow going to expand itself.
For us.
Right, for us. Because we're such, you know, well-intentioned people.
Exactly. We're working hard enough to have it happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so somehow I'm going to get 27 hours instead of the, you know, usual 24. So some of us are living in denial. Some of us are bargaining with time. That's my favorite. You know, like you can bargain your way out of it. You know, okay, honey, I'm just going to use the time that we would normally be sitting at dinner, but, you know, I'll take you on that holiday at the end of the year. If you could just give me a little bit of time here, again, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the next thing you know, your week, your month, your year has passed you by, and you're still in whatever form of denial you're in, and time has marched on. So, no, time is not the enemy at all. It's your relationship to it.
Mm-hmm. And that's constructed by us, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it starts really, really early, and that's the bit that we're not aware of. You know, we think that our relationship, the relationship that we have to time as adults, started when we were adults. But as you also write about, Francis, you know, it started way earlier than that.
It doesn't seem as if we have a problem until maybe college. Some people have a problem in college.
Yeah. Yeah.
But some get through college. I knew a guy at school who said he didn't even study.
Uh-huh.
He was the brightest guy I ever met in terms of book knowledge and
right.
ability to take tests and ace them. And
sure.
He was freaky.
Yeah.
But people usually don't have a problem until somewhere in their 20s, maybe, and in their 30s, when family comes along, the kids, they have the job becomes more demanding, they have financial obligations.
Yeah.
And all of but at that point, you tell me what you think, but it seems as if at that point, we think it's just a temporary phenomenon, or it's I'm just using the wrong smartphone, or
yeah.
I just need to find a different job, or I just need to, and then we go looking for, like you said, 10 top tips of how to, and we figure, oh, this is just a blip, but it's just a matter of finding the right tip somewhere out there, and if I keep looking for lists of tips, 10 top tips, then number 9 on the on my 15th list will be the one that does it for me, and I never have to think about it again.
Yeah.
Is that part of denial, or is that just lack of knowledge, ignorance?
You know, I think it's a combination, but I really do think it's part of the denial. Here's the difference. Like you just mentioned, you know, once you go from the only thing you have to worry about in college is basically taking your tests and doing your laundry. You know,
eating.
Your meals are prepared. You don't have to shop. Maybe if you live off campus, no cooking. You know, most of us lived in the dorms. You know,
right.
And we could get our 3 meals a day prepared. It was just a matter of standing in line and you know figuring out what you
style.
Right. You know, exactly what you want to eat, and that was the time consumption of your day. And like you just said, you know, you get family, and all of a sudden you've got to not only do that, your laundry, you've got to balance your bank book, you've got to, you know, purchase your car, you've got to do your taxes, you've got to help your kids with their homework, you know, you've got to have some time for you and your partner to maintain your relationship, you know, you've got, you know, like right now we're in the middle of the holidays, right? So you've got family obligations, you know, you've got Easter now, Easter Sunday tomorrow, what does that require? You know, if you're doing anything in your community or in your church or whatever, you've got that, you know, all of a sudden you've got all of these obligations and you're looking at your schedule going, when did this happen? You know, when did I stop having so much time? Well, it's because life showed up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
College is not life. College is a construct, you know. Mm-hmm. College is, you know, just get, you know, digest some material and spit it out on the test and regurgitate it on the test and then, you know, go on to the next subject. It's not trying to manage and integrate all the aspects of one's life together.
No, it's not.
You know,
people always put on weight in college.
Yeah.
The freshman 15.
Yes, I remember. Clearly.
Me too.
Yeah, because you're just not dealing with life, you know, as it is. It's just, you know, like you say, this construct. So, yeah.
Time occurs doesn't occur as a problem until we get somewhere into our career, maybe. And then, but at what point do people then think it becomes the enemy? I doubt it's when the problems first start.
No, yeah, because they're still, you know, in denial.
Right.
It's about, you know, mid-30s, early 40s, where they're starting to run out of energy, you know, and they can't do the juggling act anymore, and they're getting older, and they're getting, you know, more tired, and they're wondering why, you know, what used to work doesn't seem to cut it anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's when professionals or family, people that are running businesses and have families, you know, or family-oriented people, parents who are working, they get in touch with me because all of a sudden it doesn't work anymore. You know, they've run out of steam. They've, you know, run out of excuses. The denial has started to lift, and they're, you know, staring down the barrel of the next 25 years going, I can't keep up this pace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no way I can keep up this pace. Something's got to give, you know. And
if they get to the point that time becomes the enemy, that I guess the corollary of that is that they feel like victims.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If only, you know, that's when they start the whole if only conversation, you know. If only. Yeah.
Okay.
If only I had a few more hours in the day, if only people would leave me alone to get the job done, and, you know, people could be including your parents, your spouse, your kids, you know, your business partners. Yeah, that's when the, you know, the what we call the magical thinking starts to occur, you know, if only I had more time. And that's where they're starting to face the fact that they're not going to get it. Then
wow.
Now what? Okay, if only, not going to happen, now what? That's when I come in.
Wow. So is that sort of typical of your clients, is that they have already approached that point where the if only thinking has stopped working and
and
they know, realize that they need help to go past this point where I guess they don't have an idea of how much help they need because they haven't really diagnosed the problem. They just know that
yes.
The if only isn't coming anytime soon.
Correct. And by this time, you know, they've read a couple of the books and they've applied a couple of the tips and it may have, you know, made it just a fraction better. But it has not gone any, it has not come anywhere near close to solving the problem.
Mm.
Yeah, so they're in a, you know, what I like to call a pickle.
I know that's a common American phrase.
Yeah.
I'm in a pickle. In other parts of the world, it was just so. I happen to be in Trinidad, and you know people eat pickles, but to see you're in a pickle is, you know, it's not a usual everyday phrase.
Right.
It's kind of a bit funny.
I know, but it's, you know, here in America, that's what we would say. You know, in Denmark, you know, or if I'm working from Denmark, you know, then it's like I have a dilemma. You know what?
You say I have a dilemma.
That's how they're approaching it. They're like, I really have a dilemma here. You know, this is an unsolvable problem for me. I've tried. Yeah. I've looked at this from every angle. They think, and you're right. They don't know what the problem is. They just know there is a problem.
Mm.
You know, and it's my job to diagnose the cause of the problem. Yeah, which is the very first things that I do when I take on a client inside of 180-degree time management, is that we do an exercise called the Reclaiming Your Say in the Matter of Time exercise so that we can get to the root of the problem and diagnose the problem. Because what I say in 180-degree time management is that we have these decisions that we've made about time and our relationship to time, you know, from age, you know, 4. And the thing is, it's invisible. Those decisions that we made as children worked for us as children. It worked for us, like you said, in high school and college. The thing is, we're not actually aware that we're actually using the same decisions to carry us through adulthood, and they are no longer appropriate or effective. But they're there, invisible, in the background, running your relationship to time. So this exercise allows you to see what decisions did you make that are there, invisible, in the background, and running your relationship to time. So that's the, you know, that's the, okay, what now? It's the part of the discussion or the area where we go in and look at, okay, what's the diagnosis? That's the first step. Then we go into the, I'm not going to leave them there. You know, I'm not going to say, okay, this is the diagnosis. Okay, bye-bye. You know, good luck with that. So then you go into the now what, you know, and so the first thing to do is to make a new decision or make a series of 6 new decisions about your relationship to time that bring them up to date.
6 new decisions.
Yeah, 6 empowering decisions.
Okay, before we get into the details of that, actually, as you were speaking, one of my decisions came to, it just popped into my head. So when I was 15, 16, there was a major exam that we had. This was at school growing up in Jamaica.
Okay.
And we had to take a major exam. And people who know the British system would know that the 16 plus exam, which at the time was Cambridge O-levels in Jamaica.
Okay.
That was the beginning of your life or the end of it.
Yes.
If you didn't pass that, you were in deep trouble.
Yeah.
But it was the entryway to everything in your career. And everybody knew that.
Yeah.
This was like your coming out experience.
Yeah.
And because everybody would know your results because results were public, right?
Right.
So I remember giving up my favorite sport, which was cricket. So I used to play for the school, represent my school in the sport, and I remember giving it up that year. And it worked.
Yeah.
I came first in my class, and you know, yep, all of the good feelings and accolades and benefits that came from that.
Yeah.
But that was when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the decision that I made back then, based on, and you can tell me if I'm doing this right,
okay,
was to drop everything else.
Yes.
And focus on the one thing that was, and I really was just an eating, studying, sleeping, do nothing else kind of machine. Like, exercise just went out the window.
Wow.
I don't think I was doing anything.
Wow. Yeah.
But you know, when you're young, your body can take it.
Right. Exactly.
And I had a schedule that really, really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the decision that I made, which is to drop everything that wasn't important.
Yeah.
And do only that which was important.
Yeah.
And of the highest priority. And at the end of the year, when the results came out, voila.
Voila. There you go.
I came first for the first time in my 5 years of high school. I came first.
Yeah.
And I beat the really bright guy too.
Yeah.
Oh. In coming first.
Okay.
He's a doctor, by the way.
So right.
It was not just for you. But is that an example of a decision that I made? You know, because of course, I can't do that. There's no way.
Exactly. I was just getting ready to say that. I was like, yeah, try and do that now and see how your wife reacts and see how your family reacts and see how your body reacts. Drop everything and just focus on what's important. Absolutely. And that's exactly what we do. We get to that decision and we look and see how that decision is still, you know, if you haven't done any work, and I know you've done a lot of work and a lot of research, so it has come to light for you. But for people who haven't done the amount of research and work inside of time management that you and I have done, you know, it does come as a surprise that they had that decision that worked. When you were 15, 16 years old, that worked for you. That was a win-win for you.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, it doesn't work today.
No, but the truth is, though, you're right. I've done a lot of work on different aspects of my time management and of my personal life. But until you mentioned, until you distinguished it a while ago, I didn't see it
right
the way I just shared it. It was because of your explaining it that I really saw it that way for the first time. It's really interesting.
That is really, really great. And that's exactly what, you know, the Reclaiming Your Say exercise makes possible. So, you know, if you're getting one of your past decisions just from me explaining it, can you imagine if you went through the exercise with me, there may be some little demons hiding in the background, Francis, you know, that could actually be even a bigger upgrade, you know, because what if that decision is somewhere in the background running the show sometimes? What you get to do is you get to revisit that decision as an adult and go, right, okay, that worked back then. But if I'm going to put something in now, a new decision that's going to be empowering me now moving forward as an adult, what would that be? You know?
So to create a whole sort of brand new way of thinking.
Yes, exactly. And it's you declare it. You declare the new decision, and then, of course, you've got to put it into practice because we know it takes 21 days to either make or break a new habit. So you've got to, you know, put it into practice where you stop doing, you know, you make it so visible for yourself that you stop doing the old behavior for 21 days. You just practice stopping that behavior, and then for the next 21 days, you practice putting in your new decision into your behavior. And what I like about that, or what I both like about it and find effective about it, is, again, it's not the author's decision, or it's not the author's tip that you're using. You declare
right.
It, it's from your life, it's recognizable to you, and then you use it on yourself.
When I think about it, I can actually see where I did have a come to Jesus moment there. It happened when I was in college, and my girlfriend at the time. So I was trying to accelerate my program to graduate, not one but two semesters early. That didn't end well. When the dean found out I was trying to do that, and he said, "You can't do that."
Wow.
So why not? But anyway, to do it, I had to take 6 courses one semester.
Ooh.
I had like 22 credits, some crazy ridiculous course load.
Wow.
And I remember not calling my girlfriend at the time for about 3 months.
No.
And it almost ended the relationship.
Almost? Are you kidding me? You were lucky.
I'm not exactly sure how or why I got forgiven for that, but that I did get forgiven. But I think what I learned then was that 16-year-old technique where you drop everything and focus on the one thing. Because I actually did. I remember I didn't work that semester, which was the only semester I didn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I did put everything into the 22 credits or the 24 credits or whatever it was.
Wow.
And I didn't call her for 3 months.
You were doing 22 to 24 credits at Columbia University?
Cornell.
Cornell, that's right, Cornell. Sorry.
Worse, we didn't even have New York City
to distract.
Make us happy.
Oh, Cornell, in the snow. Yeah. My goodness.
That was looking back at it, it was like, jeez.
Yeah.
I thought I could do anything at that age, pretty much.
Yeah.
I thought I was still 16.
Isn't that interesting? It wasn't even that many years, you know. You would have thought that you could, you know, be, oh, this will just work. You know, that's what your mind tells you. That's what your brain tells you. You know, worked at 16, it's only been 4 or 5 years, a lot of work now. And then, you know, because you're in another time period of your life, it becomes obsolete or inappropriate.
It's exactly I didn't see that the connection between the two events until our conversation right now.
Wow!
And the fact that you're explaining it and distinguishing it, and I'm able to see what happened, and I'm able to see why I corrected it, and at the time that I did, because the cost of living that way, I decided after my girlfriend really, you know, read me the riot act. Was that it was just too high.
Yeah.
Is that it could kind of work, but my life had already become, I guess, too complicated or too intricate.
Already,
allow it to happen. At age, I guess I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
At age 20, my life had already become too complicated for that technique that worked at 16 to possibly succeed.
Right. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, and that's, so can you imagine what happens between, you know, the 3-4 years that you're mentioned, 16 and, what is that, 6 years, and then when you graduate from college and you're thrown into your work life and you're still utilizing the same techniques that you utilized at 16, and this is where you start to slide down the slippery slope. Unnoticed to yourself because, you know, the next 15 years are a blur. Okay? You're building your career. You may be getting married. You may be starting a family.
Right.
You know, and if you get really ambitious and decide, okay, I'm not going to work for any corporation. I'm going to start my own business because this is something, you know, there's some area that I'm really, really passionate about. Oh, boy.
Yes.
You know, and then you wake up one day at, you know, 35, 36, 40, and you're like, what happened? And I can't manage it anymore.
Wow. So when you do the reclaiming exercise with someone, you take them all the way back to the original decision they made about time?
Yes, I do. I do.
Huh.
And it's,
I know you have something... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, sorry.
I know you have something called hangover habits. Is that related to the original decision in some way?
It is. The hangover habits are, you know, I call them that because, it relates to that carefree time in our lives. You know, you could have shown up at an exam with a hangover, you know, because we were young and, you know, we could, you know, party all weekend and still get back to class or, you know, study on Friday and, you know, you got a terrible hangover on Sunday, but you still manage to get your notes together and then you take the exam on Monday and you get a really good grade and then you do it all again the next weekend. So I call these habits that we have from our past hangover habits because, you know, they're kind of the same sort of behavior that allowed us to skate by when we were, you know, in high school or college, and they're totally inappropriate for our lives today. You know, we can't, you know, at age 35, 40, 45, 50, we can't hang out all weekend, you know, and get up on Sunday with a hangover and, you know, prepare for the next week. We just don't have the amount of energy, yeah? So these habits that we have, like, you know, I'll give you an example of one of them. One of the habits that women have that is, I call a hangover habit, is multitasking. You know, doing a couple of different things at once. Now, multitasking, you know, women, we think we're good at it. You know, we can, we can write a report while you know, making up the shopping list, while, you know, feeding the baby, you know. But the thing is, those are different processes. If you have to focus on something that you are passionate about and that you want to present to the world, you need to stop multitasking and focus, because we can only focus on one specific, cognitive task at a time. You know, if you're doing something with your hands, that's something different. But if you're doing something that requires any kind of thinking or cognitive thought process, you need to be, you know, doing one thing. So, you know, the multitasking is one of those hangover habits that we had, that we could manage our college and high school lives with, but it's inappropriate for us now, you know.
Right. So walking and chewing gum is no problem.
Right. Exactly.
Talking, listening to your child tell you what happened that day while you're sending an email is a problem.
That is a problem. Because you're not paying attention to, you're not giving your full attention to one or the other of those events. And, mm-hmm. you know, it would be a shame if it's, you know, an email that goes awry or a business deal that goes awry because you're actually paying attention to your child, which is a good thing, or mm-hmm. the other way around, which is even more tragic. You know, how many times have we heard this? You know, mommy, look, I just made a drawing. I want to show it to you. You know, okay, just a minute, dear. I just need to finish this ... fill in the dots. You know,
right.
So the email gets sent off successfully, and your child is, you know, devastated because, you know, you're the most important person on the planet to them, and they've made this drawing from the, you know, bottom of their hearts to show how much they love you, and you're like, not now, dear, mommy's busy. Yeah.
Ooh, or even worse. Yeah, that's nice. Go ahead, I'm listening, but
they're
not.
Exactly.
They're trying to fake them out, right?
Exactly, and kids know. They know.
Well, tell me this one.
Yeah.
Because here's one thought that I've had. I have a couple of, let's just say, Ivy League graduate mm-hmm. friends who come to mind.
Uh-huh.
That they of course, you know, they're the brilliant types.
Yeah.
They are so both so engaging and so fun, and they're so smart.
Uh-huh.
But they in my observing sort of how they operate today. They at some point got into the habit of storing all of their commitments in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were brilliant and smarter, they're still smarter than 99% of the people that they, you know, they run around with.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the mental technique of managing what I have to do, managing time demands, that they always have used. And because they're, you know, they're really, really, really smart,
mm-hmm.
it's worked for them to a point. And now, when it's patently really clear that it's not working for them, so they'll miss appointments or forget to call you back or totally forget that then you mm-hmm. promised an email, they promised you an email, or totally just mm-hmm. vanish off their list.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it creates havoc in their lives, and
yeah.
For some people around them, they just kind of learn that you can't depend on them.
Wow.
And I've had the thought that bright people fall into that particular trap, that it's a hangover habit of bright people to store what they have to do in memory.
Yes.
Which then gets them into all sorts of trouble later in life. But because they're just a little bit smarter and a little bit more loquacious than the rest of us,
mm-hmm.
the rest of us schmucks who are sort of more average, they're able to talk themselves out of trouble. But the original problem actually doesn't go away. Have you seen any evidence of, like, really bright people trying to use a lot of memory and thinking
boy.
That they can get away with it for a long time?
Oh, yeah. And then the ones that come to me are the ones that, you know, exactly what you just said. You know, they are starting to have a reliability problem or a reliability challenge. People are starting to get it, even though, you know, like I say, they're very, very good at talking their way out of it. But, you know, and they don't like that about themselves either. You know, they would have prided themselves on being the ones to be able to remember everything, you know.
Yes, exactly.
You know? And now right. it's like it's falling, you know, they're starting to make mistakes and they're starting to drop vital information. And they don't like that about themselves either, you know.
Right.
They're just scrambling right. because that has become such a hangover habit. That it's like, you know, it's almost like cast in iron or written in stone. They don't know what else to do. So, you know, they're just spiraling out of control. And, you know, for every year that goes by, more items get dropped, more yeah. of their own reliability is missing. That shoots their integrity right in the foot, and then they start to get desperate, and that's when they call me.
Ooh, yeah, I could totally see it, because mm-hmm. as they get older, their memory fades.
Absolutely.
Their ability to hold on to what they call prospective memory, which is the memory of stuff that you plan to do in the future.
Yeah.
That, all the studies say it starts to diminish.
Exactly.
So let alone that your life is getting more complicated, your brain cells are also not cooperating.
Right. Exactly. That's a dilemma, as we mentioned before. That is a real dilemma.
How do you explain then? Because a hangover habit, I could imagine that for someone who realizes they have a problem,
uh-huh.
and they might even very quickly grasp that the hangover habit is the problem.
Uh-huh.
But how do you explain to someone that the habit they use for their success is now causing them to fail?
Wow, that is.
How do you do that?
Well, see, that's the reason I don't do that. I have them do the exercise, right? I do the exercise with them, and you know, because I don't tell people what their problem is. That's not a coach. A coach doesn't tell you what your problem is. A coach points, you know, a coach points you in the direction for having, you know, optimal success, and it points out what your shortcomings could be and then how you can improve upon them. So the first thing I have to do with people is they have to be able to declare what the problem is. So once we do the exercise, it's hitting them, you know, it's staring them square in the face like, oh, okay, so this no longer works. I see. Once they've done, then it's easy. You know, then I don't have to do any convincing of people. I don't try to convince people of what their issue is. I let them declare or discover or distinguish what their issue is, and then I sit there and go, okay, so that you're clear about that. That's what the issue is. Yeah, that, and I can see that now. Like you said, when you got what you got about your college experience,
yeah.
you could see that now. It was, you know,
yes,
it was an insight
yes.
from you.
Right,
you didn't tell me. It makes it a lot easier to work with people.
So you're not like you don't work like a doctor then who comes and tells you, we've discovered that your liver is this and your this is that and you need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You're not like a doctor.
No.
You're actually educating the individual with respect to their situation.
Yeah, because, you know, the thing is, they'll come to me. There is a diagnostic element of this, but basically it's like if they come to me and say, you know, if as a doctor, I don't feel well, then I'm going to start asking a whole bunch of questions. I'm not going to start giving diagnoses. I'm going to say, mm-hmm. well, you know, how much sleep are you getting? Mm-hmm. What are you eating? You know, mm-hmm. are you exercising? Do you drink water? So it's the same mm-hmm. thing with the coaching, you know, it's the same mm-hmm. thing. It's like, you know, so what is it, what kind of habits have you had already? Which ones have worked for you? What seems to be the problem? Where are you falling short? Where mm-hmm. are you getting stressed out? What's, you know, and then mm-hmm. they're telling the whole thing, and then finally they go, oh, I see, no longer works for me. And I go, okay,
So you allow their answers to help them diagnose for themselves.
Absolutely, because that's the best way to work with people. You know, if I had said to you, Francis, you know, Francis, you know, I heard about what you did in college, and that's the problem, you're going to resist it.
Yeah, I would.
How did you know, Tanya? You weren't there, and it worked for me. And especially 16-year-old, I could almost hear it in your voice, Francis. That there was such a sense of pride about what you accomplished there. You, like you said, you
out
number one guy. You know, on your test scores. So, yeah, imagine me trying to tell you, hey, Francis, that thing that you did at 16, whereas it was successful at 16, it no longer works for you. Yeah, get out of here. Of course it works for me. I use it every day.
That's so true.
Yeah.
That is so true, because I wouldn't have been ready to hear the truth. I couldn't have heard the truth from someone else, but if I could discover it for myself,
absolutely,
then it's an entirely different.
Yeah,
that's powerful coaching, right?
Yeah, I think that's the only way the coaching does work. You know, that you have an insight and you drop your defenses and say, okay, well, now that now what? You know, now I've seen this for myself. Okay, now I'm ready to take some coaching. Okay, well, now I've got a couple of things that I'd like to suggest for you. But first, the very, very first thing is that they take those six previous decisions and they make them into some empowering decisions that are going to work for their lives today. Then you've really got what I call a launch pad. You know, they're ready for launch then. And then the next thing is to like, okay, now inside of these new decisions, I've got some tools and techniques that I would like to make available for you. Are you interested?
And, yeah, and you still have the choice at that point.
You have the choice. Still have the choice. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of gets humorous, you know, because that's when all the pressure goes out the window, because they're really clear that they've got a choice all the way through. And, you know, if I happen to say something about one of their hangover habits or make a joke about it or say, you know, hey, are you actually scheduling any free time? Whereas, you know, before that would have landed like a criticism or an insult.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, yeah, that's right, because I happen to be the kind of person, you know, that has this kind of habit and I don't do that. You know, so then they can, you know, take it on themselves rather than me trying to cram it down their throats.
That makes perfect sense, and it has to be the approach that a client would prefer.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me something. Do you? And we're actually almost all the time, believe it or not. It feels like we've been talking for 5 minutes. But
yeah.
Well, how do you actually deliver the work you do with people? Do you fly all over the world and meet with people like one on one? How do you work with them in the long term? Because I imagine that you don't just talk to them for half an hour and then say, okay, you're good, that's it.
Right.
I imagine this is a process that takes a little bit of time.
Yeah, well, you know, normally there's a couple of different ways to go about it. I work with people all over the world, and yeah, it would be really time-consuming, once again, time-consuming, and expensive for me to be flying everywhere. So I work over the internet. I work with Skype, or I work with Maestro Conferencing, you know, which is a platform that, you know, they can just dial in. And, you know, there's a couple of different packages and programs that I offer people. There is I do a VIP day where, you know, we get together for the day, from like 9 to 5 or 8 to 4. And, you know, the first part of the day, the morning part, is working on, your being, you know, how you relate to time. And then the afternoon session is about how you are, working with time, you know. So the first part is about you, and the second part is about time, and that's where all the, you know, the different tools and techniques and the offer come in. And basically what we do is we crack that nut, you know, we get to what is your biggest time management challenge or nightmare, and we get to the bottom of it.
Nightmare.
A lot of, like I said, by the time people get to me, they're a little, you know, okay, I've got all this stuff going on, and things are starting to fall by the wayside, so, you know, I want to be able to, you know, manage this going forward, and I don't want to continue to live my life like this. So that's one offer. Some people have done a bit of work inside of time management, and they're just looking to, you know, to get to the bottom of what's going on moving forward. Like, I want to do some implementation, but they want the implementation of these different tools and techniques to work, again, for them as an individual, not a one-size-fits-all product. So I do a series of 6 coaching sessions where we take on a time management issue per 6 sessions. Like, if you, with the friends that you were talking about, you know, the fact that their reliability is now in question, yeah? So is it, are they late? You know, is it a lateness issue? Or is it, you know, dropping appointments? Or is it, I was just working with a fellow, and his, what we got to when he did both the VIP day and the sessions, the 6 sessions that we did following up, was that he is more interested in winging it and the adrenaline rush, was with, you know, being reliable and having his integrity in place inside of his businesses. So, you know, he was just running hither and yon trying to keep all the plates spinning, you know, because...
Oh, man, I can imagine. I think we all know somebody like that.
Yeah.
Adrenaline junkies,
exactly. And he didn't get himself as an adrenaline junkie until we did the work, you know, because it was like, look, what is it about planning that so turns you off? He's like, it's boring. And I'm like, got it, but you want to start these several businesses. Can you? And then he was able to see, yeah, that's just not going to fly. I can't continue to wing it like I did in high school. You know, I need a new approach so that I can actually get the adrenaline hit from the businesses that I'm running rather than the missed opportunities and the missed planning and the missed, you know, sessions or the missed appointments. He even missed an appointment with me, which was really interesting because I made him pay for it, you know. And
but that's more adrenaline, though. It's more, you know, it's more
right.
It's more exciting that way.
Yeah. And he saw, when he saw it, when he missed that appointment and we did the next coaching appointment, I was like, well, you know, how's that working for you? And he's like, I get it. You know, so now it's a completely different picture. So that's what we do. We take on one issue per six sessions and we really get to the bottom of it and get you to a point where that is no longer going to be an issue for you.
Oh, that's earlier you mentioned that you help people to make six decisions. Is it one decision per session?
Well, no, it's not necessarily one decision per session. They have made all of these decisions and we take each one of them and we work it through. And sometimes you're able to speed up the process because by session six, what we want to do is a review of what worked, what didn't work, and then take on a new, like, you know, quote unquote issue, you know. So no, it's not, it could be one decision per session, but my take on it is that we get to more than one per session.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the six decisions are six decisions we all make, or is it just six, a nice round number?
No, it's because of the time frames that we work within. You know, so the six time frames are 4 to 8 years old, 8 to 10 years old, 11 to 15 years old, teenager, young adult, or adult, and then from the past year. So those are the six decisions that, you know. And normally the one from the past year, it seems to be a combo. It either is a combo of the previous five or it's a result of the previous five.
Of the previous five.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's just like, you know,
that is fascinating.
It is. It really, I love, I'm so passionate about this and I love working with this, with people because, you know, when I just get to see the connection, it's so clear.
And yeah, I imagine for them it must be like, as you said, I never thought of that.
Right. Exactly. That, I hear that pretty much every day. I never saw that before.
Whoa.
Never saw.
How can people grab a hold of you?
Yeah.
What are the different channels through which you can be contacted?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's the main channel, which is my email, which is either tanya@synergypeople.dk or info@synergypeople.dk.
Tanya with a Y, right?
Tanya with a Y. Yes, correct. And then if you're on my, you can look me up on LinkedIn, you know, Tanya Dotson. And I think if you look up Coach Tanya Dotson, my profile will come up. And then there's, you know, access to my website. But I prefer people looking at the LinkedIn. That's more updated. You know, the work I do, I keep updating my LinkedIn. I'm not a web designer.
You're also on Twitter, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, Tanya Dotson, at Synergy People.
Tanya Dotson.
At Synergy People.
It's at Synergy People, okay.
Yeah.
At Synergy People.
Yes.
Great. Tanya, man, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us. There's, you know, we get people listening in who are time advisors.
Uh-huh.
They're trainers and coaches, and I know they got value from it as well as people who just want to get some insights about how do they become more effective and how do they experience peace of mind and what's getting in the way and where do they have these hangover habits and you know, you've just given us a wealth of information that. And I think I've been around the block a little bit that I didn't know.
Great.
And I certainly found something about my own self that I had never seen before. And if that comes from just being on a radio interview, I can't imagine what six sessions would look like. So I sure hope people take the extra step and get a hold of you if they have any kind of issue or even a question. Because I think you would help people to answer all these questions that they don't have for themselves. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, that is. And thank you so much for saying that. I love the way that the work actually works on the court. This is just how I work, you know, on the court, having a conversation, you having, you know, as the client, having an insight, haven't seen that before, and then, you know, we get into how can we upgrade that behavior so that you can have, you know, the result that you want. So I'm so pleased that it happened with you on the court in this interview because that gives a really good indication of how I do work.
Fantastic. Great. Tanya Dotson, thanks for coming on our show. And stay tuned, there's more coming up here on the Two Time Labs podcast. Keep listening.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Two Time Labs podcast with Tanya Dotson. First of all, a big thank you to her for appearing on our show and being willing to give me coaching live and direct so everyone could get the benefit that I also got.
And if you like the show, please take a moment to find it on iTunes, leave a comment, and give us a really nice rating. And if you're interested in more of the ideas that we use here at Two Time Labs, visit my website at perfect.mytimedesign.com or buy the book Perfect Time-Based Productivity on amazon.com. Take care, and I wish you all the best. Bye now.